Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced American foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. My normal co-host and partner in all things strategic, Elliot Cohen, the Robert E. Osgood Professor of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, is unfortunately traveling and he can't join us. But we have as a special guest today, David Sanger, the Chief Washington Correspondent of the New York Times. He's been part of three Pulitzer Prize winning teams at the Times. And has been covering national security for the New York Times for 30 some odd years. He's also the author of four books, The Inheritance, which was about the sort of final years of the Bush administration and what the Obama team was walking into, Confront and Conceal, which was about the first rocky shakedown cruise years of the Obama administration. That's my characterization, not David's. The Perfect Weapon, about cyber, and now New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. David, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Well, thanks very much. It is great to be back with you here, Eric. And I'm just sorry along the way that we don't have Elliot along as well, because before he was all of those distinguished things that you mentioned, he was a teaching fellow who taught me in my sophomore year. And were he here, he could explain how little I have learned since.
So like Socrates with Alcibiades, we're going to hold him responsible for anything that you've said or done that's wrong here.
Especially since he's not here, every single word.
David, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about how you came to write this book? It's really, in some ways, it's really focused on the first 3 years of the Biden administration, but it does have a kind of retrospective element to it as well, looking back on how the United States got the arc of the trajectory of Russian and Chinese behavior and policy wrong. So how did you come to write this?
Well, Eric, I've now been in the Washington Bureau of the Times for 30 years. I came in 1994, ending a happy life as a Times foreign correspondent. On the theory of the New York Times is that happiness is in direct proportion to your distance from Times Square. And I was living in Tokyo for 6 years, so I was as happy as could be. But they asked me to come back here, and as I was settling in to this book and thinking about it, I'm beginning to sketch it out during COVID with my great co-writer, Mary Brooks, who is of a different generation and thinks about America a little differently than I do. What struck me the most was how almost every major assumption we had when I got back here in 1994 about how China and Russia would see it in their overwhelming economic interest to rejoin the Western or join the Western community, sign up for their institutions. China was into the WTO. Russia was talking about joining the European Union and maybe even joining NATO. Do you remember those days? This is soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia had an office inside the NATO headquarters.
Yeah, I remember I was somewhat
part of
involved.
The Russia and NATO Council. Yes, just a little bit. And so the question I wanted to go grapple with in the first part of the book was, how did we get all of this wrong? I mean, you know, we were wrapped up in the questions of some intelligence failures about whether or not Saddam Hussein was building weapons of mass destruction and all that. And those are interesting questions. But compared to the trajectory of your two major nuclear rivals seems to be, to me, to be, you know, relatively small bore stuff. And yet it was the biggest one that we judged wrong. And I wouldn't say that that was necessarily an intelligence failure. I would say that was also a matter of wishful thinking on the part of Republicans and Democrats. And there's a lot of blame to go around here. You know, I was with Bill Clinton when he went to Beijing University and said, the internet will set you free and undercut the Communist Party. And by the way, trying to censor the internet is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. Well, this morning in the New York Times, there was a brilliant column written by one of my colleagues, Chinese-born colleague, about how China is literally destroying the memory of the internet by taking almost everything that happened between 2005 and 2015 offline. So you can't go back into the history of what Chinese leaders said during that time. You know, so that's one. And then comes along George W. Bush. Remember him? I think you may have worked for him for a little bit. And, you know, it was Bush who met Putin 24, 25 times. There's a scene early in the book where they are floating down the Neva River together in St. Petersburg. It was a beautiful evening. It was just about this time of year, early June. I was in the backup boat along the way. When we went aboard the yacht there, well, first of all, they were eating and drinking much better than we were in the backup boat, I can tell you that. But the second was there was this sort of lurking guy who was standing in the background overseeing the service of dinner. Guess who he was, right? Although we didn't know his name at the time. And the discussion on the boat, as I reconstructed it with those who had been with them that night, was all about the EU and eventual NATO membership and how you were going to get visas for Russians to come to the United States and learn high technology and bring it back to diversify the Russian economy. And when you read this stuff today, Eric, it's like we were living in a different world.
Yeah, sure. I mean,
now that does not. That does not suggest that there were people who were saying, "Hey, superpower conflict could be back." And I think you were in that crowd.
Yeah. So I was going to say, I mean, it's not like, you know, nobody saw this coming. I mean, my SAIS colleague and former colleague of yours in the Fourth Estate, Jim Mann, you know, wrote a book called The China Fantasy a number of years ago, talking about the idea that we're going to civilize China by, you know, making a member of the WTO. And as my Bush administration colleague, Bob Zelick, said, a responsible stakeholder in international system is probably never going to happen. Back in 2008, in fact, I think you reviewed it, Bob Kagan wrote The Return of History, you know, that we're headed toward back towards, great power competition. And I know that in the book, you talk about the assumption, and you were correct, that a lot of people had it, that American power would remain unchallenged. But, you know, I myself wrote a paper in 2010 for CSBA, which was entitled, you know, Dealing with America's Contested Primacy, because clearly, people saw some of this coming. So I guess my question to you is, if you were of a more hawkish disposition or a more dovish disposition, and you were looking at the world in 2010, who would have been more correct in their prognostications about what was to come, you know, looking back at it now?
Well, clearly the hawks would have been more correct, but I'm not sure that they fully understood at the time what the nature of the competition would be. because while the book is called New Cold Wars, the most important word there is new, and the most important letter there is the S at the end of war, right? Because this is quite different, and quite different even from what the hawks were saying at the time. Putin is not trying to recreate the old Soviet Union. He thinks the old Soviet leaders were idiots who gave far too much power to the republics and all that. He is trying to go back and recreate the Russia of Peter the Great, of which Ukraine, of course, was a significant part. Xi Jinping really hid his true ambitions. As he was rising as essentially the vice president and power in waiting, the U.S. assigned a guy named Joe Biden, then our vice president, to go spend a lot of time with him. And Biden got to know him fairly well. But there was nothing in their conversations, as I described in the book, that would have led you to understand something different from what the CIA and others were assessing at the time, which was that China would, at their assessment was that China would focus on economic development, not challenge the West. And what do we know now? That as soon as Xi came in, he gave a series of secret speeches to the party leadership and the military, saying we're going to build up our nuclear force to be equivalent in size to the Russian and the American ones. So if we ever get forced into a discussion on arms control, we're all starting from the same place. By the way, not an unreasonable position for him to have taken. He's obviously, when he stood up with Barack Obama in the South on the South Lawn, or the Rose Garden, I guess, and said that China had no interest in militarizing the South China Sea. Well, that turned out to be wrong. When he said that they would crack down on the cyber attacks on the United States, well, that was truly wrong. So we really misjudged along the way what we were facing. I think the most expensive misjudgment of all, though, was the technological misjudgment. The inability to understand that the true competition was not going to be in who had the most nukes, but who could make 3-nanometer dimension semiconductors, produce them at mass, not be relying on your adversary's supply chain, not being over-reliant on Taiwan given its vulnerability. And even to this day, I think if you walked into Congress, and I make this point at the end of the book, and you say, we have a huge deficit with the Chinese in new ships being built, so we need 10 new aircraft carriers, which, by the way, I wouldn't advocate building given what sitting ducks they are, but let's say you said that, I think you'd get that money relatively quickly. There'd be some hemming and hawing, but you'd get it. If you walked in and you said, I need 10 new semiconductor fabrication plants, which, by the way, cost more than aircraft carriers, each one of them, then that would be a very different thing.
Yeah, I mean, you talk at some length and in a very, I think, careful way about the whole deindustrialization of the offshoring of semiconductors by the United States. I mean, the innovation and the design all came from the United States, and we just made a business decision, essentially, in industry to have the production, you know, move offshore for understandable reasons. But long-term consequences didn't become evident until later, as you say.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's something, an area where my biggest concern is not that we are using industrial policy to get it going, it's that we're not moving fast enough. One of the things I think that Biden has done right here has been, in the second half of the book, and, you know, dives you deep into how the Biden administration has dealt with this, I think one of the things he's done right has been to do the export controls, to make sure that China could not get many of those weapons, many of those chips, and also to do the controls to make sure that China couldn't get the equipment to go build those chips. But the fact of the matter remains that if you took all of the semiconductor plants that we are building today and you use the most optimistic projection of the Biden administration about where we would be in 2030, what you get is a projection that we would still be reliant on China, Taiwan, and outside producers for 80% of the most advanced semiconductors. If we had said to Congress, you would be dependent on outside supply for 80% of our ammunition, there would be a huge uproar. But 80% on the semiconductors still seems to be okay with people. And I'm having a hard time understanding why that's the case.
We've talked a lot about China. Let's move a little bit to the to what's happened with Russia, because that is something that you've covered in great detail. And you actually the day we're recording have a piece in the New York Times about in part about President Biden's relationship with President Zelensky, which has been a very fraught relationship from the beginning, as you describe in the book as well. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit about that relationship.
Well, Zelensky, of course, you know, comes into power as a former comedian, right? I open one chapter with a scene from his old TV show where he gets a call from Angela Merkel. It's a fictional conversation. And he thinks that they've just been invited into the European Union. And then he discovers that she meant to call another country and, you know, goes off into a cursing tirade. Well, the cursing tirades continued, Eric. And they continued as he was in office. Of course, he gets caught up in the whole Trump impeachment stuff, right, which we forget now, given everything else that's happened with Trump, was actually all about his relationship, the first impeachment, with Ukraine and his effort to try to hold up weapons in return for getting dirt on Joe Biden. So he comes to this with a little bit of attitude about what it's like to go deal with the American political process. Then he goes to the Munich Security Conference the weekend before the war breaks out and tells everybody, me included, the war is not going to happen because he thinks it's bad for his economy if people, you know, become too convinced that they're going to be invaded. Well, 4 days later, they're invaded. And while I think Biden used that time very well to both turn out the intelligence in advance to suggest that what Putin had in mind and sent Bill Burns to go warn Putin and use that time to sort of organize the allies so that they would be ready to impose sanctions and begin to ship arms as soon as the invasion happened. The fact of the matter is it didn't deter Putin from invading. And as soon as the invasion happens, not surprisingly, Zelensky's on the phone to Biden saying he needs everything. Well, the first thing he needed actually was communications, and it was a good thing the U.S. gave him some secure communications because the Russians went to extraordinary lengths, which I describe in the book, to cut it off, to knock out the satellite system that was feeding Ukraine and so forth. The second thing he asked for is every major weapon system out there, F-16s, ATACMS, tanks. If Eric Edelman put these weapons into the U.S. system, Vladimir Zelensky wanted to get them out to him, okay? And I don't blame him. If I had been in his job, I probably would have done the exact same thing and probably would have been emailing you for an inventory list if I had one. Biden got pretty pissed off at this. He thought that Zelensky was not grateful for what the U.S. had done. He thought that if the U.S. had not stood up the way he did, that Zelensky would have been executed in some back room and the country would have already been in Russian hands. Zelensky thought when you sat down and talked to the President of the United States, the first thing you brought with you was a shopping list. The shopping list pissed off Biden, right? And it got to the point where the U.S. basically had to put Zelensky into training about how you talk to an American president. You talk big principles, and then you send off, you set your national security advisors or your deputy national security advisors or your number three in the Pentagon, just to pick a job out of the hat, to go negotiate out what weapon systems you're going to be sending. This got the relationship off to a bad start. It improved, but in recent times, even in recent weeks, it became tense again because Zelensky was saying, we need to be able to shoot these weapons into Russian territory because they are using their Russian territory to shoot into Ukraine. And Biden dropped a 27-month-long insistence that U.S. weapons never be put into that. And that, in and of itself, I thought was interesting.
So my question about that is, it strikes me that this shows a kind of, and surprising for Biden, who's been in this business for 40 years, as he likes to point out, a kind of striking lack of strategic empathy. I'm not saying that Biden needed to give, you know, Zelensky everything that he asked for, and certainly not, you know, everywhere and all at once. But it does strike me that when you're dealing with a guy that the Russians are trying to assassinate, who's in the midst of a, you know, existential struggle for, you know, to save his country, that you might have a certain amount of, you know, sympathy for his position, or at least empathy for his position. You think I'm being too harsh?
I think Biden had empathy for his position, but I think even Biden misjudged the speed at which Republicans in Congress would grow tired of supporting democracy. I mean, the old Republican Party, the Republican Party you grew up in, Eric, would have only gained enthusiasm for this fight as time went on. Instead, half of the Republican Party voted against the most recent $65 billion, right? So what does that tell you? That Biden recognized, I think, that he couldn't get too far out ahead of where the politics of this were in the United States. Remember, the first time Zelensky came here to the U.S., when they flew him in secret, he addressed a joint session of Congress. There were so many standing ovations, people's feet got tired. The second time he came back, the Republicans wouldn't even allow him to address a joint session of Congress, and the speaker had to go move the entire conversation to the National Archives so that it didn't require a congressional vote about whether to let him talk.
No, fair enough. I mean, you know, on the other hand, you know, you talk in the book, I think, correctly about the administration having the sense that if they only pulled the right levers, they would be able to manage and control, you know, Putin's level of escalation. And escalation management seems to be the watchword that they have, which some of us have criticized.
Cautious to a fault. Right.
So, I mean, does the fact that they have repeatedly said no and then subsequently relented and provided these weapons to Ukraine, and as you just pointed out, you have now released at least some of the limitations on range of and hitting some targets in Russia, does that not suggest that they've been perhaps erring too much on the side of caution? And I want to specifically get into the nuclear question in a minute, but I just now I'm talking about the conventional fight.
I think it does, but I think what it also tells you is they have learned along the way. If you had asked almost anybody, Democrats or Republicans, those in the administration and those who had dealt with Putin before from Republican administrations, how would Putin react to bringing in attackers? How would Putin react to bringing in F-16s or Abrams tanks or the British Storm Shadow missiles? I think we all guessed that there would probably be a larger reaction than there was, and that the red lines were wrong. I think Biden was particularly cautious on this. I think it's a product of his growing up in the old Cold War escalation scenarios and maybe not updating them for the modern era. That said, I also think they could have moved more quickly, particularly on the question of whether or not these weapons could get fired into Russia. It's interesting to note that our allies were usually more cautious than we are, particularly the British, moved on this issue months ahead of Biden.
Yes. Well, let me talk a little bit about the nuclear piece, because that cage has been rattled again recently with a nuclear exercise that the Russians and Belarusians held. You cover this in some detail, and we talked earlier with your CNN colleague, Jim Sciutto, who has also reported on this subject and has covered it in a book that he published a little bit ago. This is the issue of the nuclear threats the Russians have made, and in particular, the danger that in the sort of winter of 22, these threats were perhaps becoming not just threats, but, you know, actual plans to potentially use theater nuclear weapons. I hate the word tactical, because a tactical nuclear weapon is, your judgment of whether it's tactical or strategic is equal to your square root of your distance from the aim point, right? Because these things are hugely destructive.
Right.
And so I guess my question is, if you look at Putin's statements, he does rattle the nuclear cage, no question. But all of those kind of threats are by and large very vague and general threats. Whenever he's been asked specifically, and he has been asked multiple times specifically, including recently, do you have any intention of using nuclear weapons in Ukraine? He answers the same way. He said, I have absolutely no, there's no need, no use for nuclear weapons in Ukraine. And the Russian foreign ministry has signed, you know, multiple statements at various points, or signed on to, I should say, multiple statements about nuclear war should, can't be won and should never be fought. So how seriously should we have taken these threats in December of 2022? Is there at least a possibility that these were clearly intended? This was based in a lot of ways, as you make clear, on overheard conversations by national technical means of intelligence. Russians knew we were monitoring this. They knew this from the what you described earlier, the declassification of intelligence before the war began. How much of this was real, and how much of this was intended for our ears in order to make the U.S. more cautious about providing things like ATACMS and other things that were, you know, under consideration at that point, which the administration was still withholding?
Well, let me start by answering the second part of your question first. Putin knows that this is what rattled our cage, and particularly Joe Biden's cage, more than anything else. So naturally, he's going to turn to it. He knew we were listening in on some of his commanders, and you raised the really good possibility that he was playing off of that to basically stage discussions for our benefit. That said, I think actually Biden got this one about right. First, as you recall from the days after 9/11, even if there's only a 1% chance or a half of a percent chance of the use of a nuclear weapon, the downside risk of that, or the result of that, is so great that you have to take it pretty seriously, even if you think the chances are really, really small. Because if you're wrong, even on a 1 in 100 chance, you have just made the you lose your country bet, or you lose another country bet. I think the risk in October of 2022, the period of time I cover pretty thoroughly, and Jim Sciutto does in Return of Great Powers, his very good book, was pretty serious. They had multiple lines of intelligence that suggested that the commanders who are responsible for the movement of tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons, were in fact in a serious conversation about how they might get employed It did not look like they had instructions yet from Putin to go use them. But by the time that happened, it would be too late for Biden to act. And so they started a crazy weekend of calls between Secretary Austin and his counterpart, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and his counterpart. They brought in the Chinese and the Indians, ultimately, to get them to pressure Russia to not use these weapons. There were many in the administration who said they thought there was a 50-50 chance the weapons would be used. I can't evaluate from the outside whether that number was real or not, but I'm sure it felt like it seemed a pretty high possibility at the time based on the intel they had. There was one remarkable evening, which I describe in the opening of one of the chapters, in which Biden shows up at a fundraiser in New York at the home of James Murdoch. Biden's always most interesting at the fundraisers because he's always somehow a little more loquacious.
Joe Biden unplugged.
Yes. And, you know, he started discussing it. It happened to be that week was the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he started off by saying to the people who were there walking around looking at the art collection with, you know, nice glasses of white wine in their hands, there is a serious chance of a nuclear exchange in the next couple of weeks. You know, everybody's in the room is probably thinking, how fast can I get out to the Hamptons and dig a tunnel under my summer house, right? I think they took it seriously. But I think over time, they have come to the conclusion that Putin has reached for the nuclear card a few times too many, that he recognizes that this is the way he could lose China and others who he needs, but he doesn't want to give it up. And thus those exercises you saw just the other day.
I mean, I guess the thing that still inclines me to skepticism, David, is there was no indication of actual movement of any weapons by the 12th GUMO, which is the department of the Ministry of Defense that handles transport of nuclear weapons. It's also the case, I know, that, you know, our intelligence community would tell you if you asked them that we wouldn't necessarily see that, you know, if it was happening. So you can't, you know, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, as one of my former bosses used to say. So I take that point. But it does seem to me that if you were really getting ready to use theater weapons, you would have put your strategic weapons on alert because you wouldn't be able to know ahead of time what the adversary's reaction would be, and you'd have to be prepared, it seems to me. So I guess I'm still just inclined to skepticism about this, but I'm more than willing to admit I could be wrong.
You know, I think the people I interviewed who were involved in the discussion were more than willing to admit that they were could have been wrong and would have been very happy to be wrong. And of course, we know a nuclear weapon did not go off. But I suspect that if you or I or anybody else who has been involved in 30 years and thinking about nuclear possibilities thought that there was even a remote chance, you'd be working pretty hard to cut it off.
Fair point. I want to just go back to China for one second, because you quote some folks and you make it pretty clear you don't agree with them. But on China, there is an argument that's been made that we should be very careful with China. We don't want to get into an action reaction, tit for tat, and make conflict with China a self-fulfilling prophecy. And, you know, you see this written in a variety of places. We hosted Professor Dale Copeland at UVA a few weeks ago, who's written a new book on this, which sort of makes that argument. I have to say, I just haven't seen that, you know, evidence that at least on the geopolitical front, that there has been an action reaction sort of relationship here or self-fulfilling prophecy. On the contrary, as you make clear in the book, and as you have made clear in your comments today, for the longest time, the United States, you know, underestimated, you know, the Chinese. In fact, I, you know, as someone who follows the weapons developments, we've consistently underestimated their production of certain weapons, whether it's fighter jets, bombers, anti-ship ballistic missiles. I mean, we've always
hypersonics.
We've always underestimated, not overestimated, their capabilities and the timeline of those coming on the scene. So, could you talk about that a minute? Because I think you also have a view about an area where it might actually have been the case.
Sure. So there is certainly a risk, and I can understand why critics say this, that everything that you overreact to just feeds the Chinese narrative that the United States and its allies are out to contain them, and therefore that they should be more self-sufficient, that they should build more of their own semiconductors, their own weapons, that they need to make sure that the world is dependent on China and China is not dependent on the world. And you don't want to feed that cycle. But I guess where I came out of after 4 years of working on this book and traveling around the world to go do it, because this is really, as you, I think you've seen, a book of reporting. This was not a book of David sits in Washington and thinks about these issues. It was a get out and talk to leaders and deputies and foreign ministers and defense ministers and everybody else around the world. And I guess where I came out at the end of this was China has put the development of these key technologies, the ones that are in the Made in China 2025 project, into overdrive. Sometimes that's worked. Batteries, electric cars, autonomy. Sometimes it hasn't. Semiconductors, some kinds of weapons. And they've got the advantage that they have been able to marshal all of their national elements of power together. The technologists know that they are working for the government first. That is certainly not the case in Silicon Valley, right? I'm not suggesting it should be, but they have a lot faster way of organizing themselves around specific missions. That doesn't mean they're always going to succeed. And we have woken up very slowly.
On the contrary, you make the case very persuasively that you talk about Project Maven and all the problems that Google had getting its workforce to even be willing to work with the U.S. Department of Defense.
That's right. That's right. And Maven is just now beginning to take off, as I describe in the book, in part because we've had the experiment of Ukraine to deploy it and see what works in it in putting together battlefield management and see what doesn't. And that's actually been a great benefit. I mean, one shouldn't say this about a horror that has killed, hundreds of thousands of people on combined between the two sides and displaced and wounded so many more. But for the Pentagon, it has been a huge learning curve in what works in the U.S. system and what does not. The U.S. deployed more than a dozen Skyeo U.S.-made drones to Ukraine, and the Russians took every one of them out of the sky in about 48 hours. Okay? You're learning a lot from that pretty fast that you wouldn't learn if you were in a normal Pentagon procurement process, right? Trying to test things under ideal conditions. So I think we have underreacted to particularly the technology competition with China. As the book lays out, there were many people in the Trump administration, unfortunately not including the president himself, who were highly aware of this and getting organized on it, but they never actually were able to act on it because the president couldn't focus. Biden actually has acted on it. My only critique is he hasn't gone fast enough, as I suggested before. And that raises the interesting question. While we are sitting around in this era of remarkable division and arguing over threats to democracy that are vitally important in my mind, arguing over the age of our presidential candidates and so forth, we have had absolutely no discussion in this campaign on either side about what big lessons we need to learn from the Ukraine war for our own future defense or for defending Taiwan. And most importantly, Eric, we have not even had the discussion of what do you do about the biggest fundamental change which has taken place since you left government, which is Russia and China coming together, not always easily, not always efficiently, but coming together, and what the implications are for U.S. defenses if Russia and China can actually coordinate. They are managing to do now what Nixon and Kissinger got in the way of them doing in the 70s, right? Or what we feared that they would go out and do. And I haven't heard Donald Trump or Joe Biden discuss this topic once during the campaign. Maybe I missed it. If I was on vacation that day, correct?
No, I know you're exactly right about that. And I mean, that actually leads to the next topic I wanted to get into, which is something you do address in the book. You do talk about the Chinese nuclear buildup and the fact that that really presents the United States with a totally novel problem that we've never faced since the advent of the nuclear age in 1945, which is the requirement to potentially deter two nuclear peers. I mean, even though China tested a nuclear weapon in 1964, its arsenal has been relatively small compared to the U.S. and Soviet and Russian arsenals. But it's now growing very rapidly, growing apace, with projections that it will reach parity with the United States and Russia, or at least the levels we have under the new START treaty, which expires in 2026, of 1,550 warheads deployed each, by the middle of the 2030s. Now, given what I said earlier about the fact that we've consistently underestimated them, they could well arrive at that number, you know, much sooner than the middle of the 30s. It could be at the end of this decade easily, which is only 6 years away. So it's not that far away. And the question becomes, how do you deter two peers? I mean, traditionally, we define strategic stability by having the ability to ride out a first strike by your adversary and still have enough so-called second strike retaliatory power to be able to inflict unacceptable damage, you know, on the adversary. Problem is, if you've got, you know, arsenals that are roughly equivalent and you have a second strike capability against one adversary, if you actually had to use it, you would in effect leave yourself without a strategic reserve to deal with the other. And that doesn't even get into the contingency that you were kind of pointing to, which is, what if they actually concerted, you know, for instance, a nuclear first strike? And while in the Cold War, those, you know, bolt from the blue first strike scenarios always seemed, you know, a little bit remote, although both the Soviet Union and the United States had experienced bolt from the blue attacks in 1941. Seems to me not theoretically out of the question the Russians and Chinese could plan something like this. And I'm particularly concerned, you describe in the book the discovery of the launch of the Chinese missile that was, you know, in technical terms described as a FOBS, a fractional orbital bombardment system. This was a missile fired west rather than east, so which is the normal trajectory for missiles to be fired, so that it would be difficult to track. And in fact, came at the United States from the south because it circumnavigated the world and was, would have arrived on target.
Which is exactly where our missile defenses are not
exactly. And would have arrived on target had it been not a test, but a real missile with, you know, low or no warning to the United States national leadership. It's hard to imagine what purpose this would serve unless you were looking for something like a decapitating first strike. So how do you think about deterring two nuclear peers, David?
So let me take your narrower question first, what the Chinese intended here, and then let's get to the two nuclear peers. So it's possible that the Chinese were looking for a way that you could do a first strike that would completely evade our missile defenses. They maintain that their hypersonic weapons are going to be carrying non-nuclear warheads. But, you know, as we know ourselves, you can put a nuclear warhead in just as easily as you could put a non-nuclear warhead in. So you have to assume it would be. I think the message they were sending was, you know, guys, numbers don't really matter out here. Long before we get to our 1550 that you mentioned, we will have capabilities that will be so good at evading your missile defenses that even if we had a force of 500, as they believed to have now, or 1,000, we will have plenty of first and second strike capability out there. So I think that was their deeper message. I think their second message was, I know that Americans all think that the way China gets technology is by stealing it from the United States. They've done a lot of that. The F-35 was a good example. You and I could probably put together a pretty good list over beers of all the technologies come away with. But this is one that, like TikTok, was kind of born in China. And I think they were making a point about that as well. To your broader point about whether or not China and Russia could coordinate, we're still trying to explore and understand what the partnership without limits is. We know that there really are some limits in the partnership without limits, right? We know that China is frequently not happy with Putin. We know that China does not like the nuclear saber rattling. We know that China thinks that Putin wildly overestimated his ability to take out Ukraine when he went and visited Xi Jinping in those days just before the opening of the Beijing Olympics. And that's a scene that's played out at some length in the book and what U.S. intelligence thinks the two of them talked about that day. But at the same time, one of the great utilities of the new relationship between Russia and China is that it can make us think about worst-case scenarios in which they would coordinate their nuclear activity. And we would have to think about spending vast amounts of money building a huge nuclear force to go match the combined Russia and China force. Now, I think we may need to build some more. I don't think we need to double or triple the size of our nuclear force, and, you know, that's probably worthy of a separate broadcast on Shield of the Republic about what where the right numbers are. But the fact of the matter is that having two nuclear powers working together is a vastly more complicated problem for us than simply having one. One of the nice things about the old Cold War was we settled into a little bit of a predictability to it because we knew who had launch authority on their side and they knew who had launch authority on our side. And there was a big red telephone on either end. And, you know, you had a pretty good idea who was going to answer it, or at least you thought you knew who was going to answer it. And once you've got multiple players, all that certainty goes out the window.
No, that's exactly right. And I agree with you. I don't think we need to match the Chinese and Russian combined arsenals, warhead for warhead. But I also think probably that the new START limits, will not be sufficient. But there are things we can do. I mean, there's upload of our ICBMs from one warhead back up to three. There's a lot of things we can do. But I don't think we're kind of there yet. In kind of our understanding of what we'll do.
Eric, can I just make one more point? One more point on this issue. It's a great thing that, you and I and, 150 of our closest personal friends can sit here and debate it. But there was an era once in the United States when the question of nuclear deterrence and what it took to go deal with this was actually the subject of regular campaign debate at a fairly high level. And so I'd urge your listeners, only after they have heard every last episode of of Shield of the Republic. To go download the YouTubes of one of the Nixon-Kennedy debates from 1960 and turn off the video so that you're not thinking about who looked, you know, young and healthy and who looked like he was sweating through the thing. Just listen to it while you're driving one day or something, so you're forced only to hear the audio. And ask yourself this question. Could you imagine in the presidential race of 2024 that we had a detailed discussion between the candidates, forget who you agreed with and disagreed with, about the inner workings of nuclear deterrence? And then ask the question, what happened to us that we are no longer able to discuss this topic?
It's a great question, and I agree with you totally. And I mean, the reality is we've kind of taken a holiday from, you know, thinking about this subject. It's a, you know, particularly morbid subject.
Well, one of the messages of new Cold Wars is holiday is over, folks.
Yeah, I agree.
Right.
Just sticking with the nuclear question, because we're running out of time and I want to kind of wrap up. But the Biden administration came in, and you've written about this in your reporting. You cover it a bit in the book. They came in after President Trump's withdrawal from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran, the agreement that limited Iran's nuclear program, negotiated in the Obama administration. They came in with a determination to get back into the agreement, although there was an acknowledgement both in the Democratic platform and in Secretary Blinken's confirmation testimony that we needed to have a longer and stronger agreement, because some of the timelines of the 2015 agreement, the various 10 and 15 year timelines, were already coming up pretty quickly, actually, on a variety of different things, including the lapsing of the United Nations Security Council ban on ballistic missile exports by Iran. They tried to engage with Iran under Rob Malley, who was the lead negotiator, who has been in a kind of state of suspended animation for the last year while his security clearance is being has been suspended, and while his own handling of classified information is being investigated by the FBI. It appears to me they have no alternative policy, that they seem to be even a little bit, you know, as you described in Ukraine, a little bit behind the allies on this, who seem to be more concerned about the state of Iran's nuclear enrichment than we are, and more willing to condemn it in the IAEA Board of Governors, the UN international agency that monitors all of this stuff. So what is your take on this? What do you think their policy is at this point?
So let me start with first principles, which is, up until the moment that President Trump exited the agreement, I would say the Iranians were imperfectly following almost all of its major precepts. The deal got 97% of the fuel out of the country. It did not get rid of the actual equipment that enabled the Iranians to produce more, but they weren't producing more at that time from the best intel we and our allies could put together and the IAEA inspectors. So I think when you go back and you look at this history, and I spent a year and a half of my life that I will never get back covering the negotiations over the Iran nuclear deal, I think will regard the decision to get out of a deal that was working as a colossal error. That does not mean that today in 2024, we wouldn't be facing the possibility that that deal was going to run out, because by 2030, under the terms of the deal, there were no restraints on Iran. But the fact of the matter is, right now, there are basically no restraints on Iran because the deal is gone. So whatever time we were buying with this for new leadership to come in, we threw it away. Okay. Second point is, when the Biden administration came in to go try to reconstitute the deal, I think it was a little bit naive to think that they could just come in and try to renegotiate the dates and make it longer and stronger and not give up something to the Iranians in return, right? The Iranians have been negotiating on a variety of issues for about 4,000 years. They're actually pretty good at it, as we learned in the initial negotiation. And so now we've gotten to the point where even if you could reconstitute the old deal, you wouldn't do it because it runs out in 6 years and pieces of it run out this year and next year. So it's fundamentally useless. You got to start from the beginning. The administration has made the, has concluded, I think, that first, there's very little to be gained in their mind from doing a resolution that will have no real effect other than perhaps to drive the Iranians to respond by building quicker. I'm not saying I endorse this. I'm just telling you what they're thinking is. Second, I think they've come to the conclusion since the helicopter crash that killed President Raisi that if you passed a resolution now, it would probably help the hardliner candidates more than the non-hardliner candidates, although it looks to me from the likely nominees out here that we're talking about, you'd need a micrometer to find the difference between hardliner and less hardline in this case. Okay. And third,
this is what my former boss Bob Gates used to call the elusive search for the Iranian moderates that has marked American policy on Iran since 1980.
That's right. Right. And we're still involved in that search, and it's gotten it's gone about as well since you left government as it was going before you entered.
Right? Exactly.
So, and then I think the third thing is, I think this administration is just overwhelmed right now in the Middle East. They're trying to manage Bibi Netanyahu for which, you know, is sort of a full-time job. Okay. They're trying to manage the Saudi deal, which I think they have very little chance of getting together, but I can understand why they're pursuing it. They're trying to deal with Hamas and its remnants. And they think something that revives the possibility of a confrontation with Iran is exactly what we don't need right now. So I think they're kind of whistling past. That would be fine if the Iranians had not enriched enough material and to 60%, just short of bomb grade, for three nuclear weapons by my sort of back of the envelope calculations. Maybe it's four. And if this same set of enrichment activities were taking place a decade ago, the front pages would be full of questions like, when will Israel begin the bombing? So I can understand and even sympathize with why they don't want to go deal with it, but let's not kid ourselves. The Iranians have now come back from the abandoned deal by building and enriching to a level that we never saw before that deal was signed. President Trump promised that after he pulled out of the deal, the Iranians would come begging for a new deal from him. I must have been away the day that happened.
It's true, but you know, it's also the case that the maximum pressure campaign was actually having quite an effect on the Iranian economy, and that there were pretty big protests in Iran over the declining economic situation, which very quickly spilled over into more political protests in 18 and 19. And I agree with you that it was, foolish for the Biden folks to believe that they were going to, come in and get a deal without giving something to the Iranians. But they did give some things to the Iranians, right? They stopped enforcing the sanctions on oil sales, essentially. And they, they de-designated the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, which is something that the Trump administration had done. So, I mean, they did make concessions to the Iranians to try and, kind of sweeten the pot and get back in the deal making business. It just didn't it didn't work. And predictably, I mean, having pocketed those concessions, the Iranians obviously wanted more.
That's absolutely right. And now we are where we are, which is that the most important thing we need to do is get the 60% enriched uranium out of Iran so that if there is a crisis in the future, you are not afraid that that disappears one day. IAEA inspectors are totally barred. Right now, they're just, you know, mostly barred, right? And suddenly you're wondering where that enriched uranium went and whether it was going to turn into a bomb. And, you know, if it was only one bomb's worth, I'm not sure I'd be that concerned about it. But when you got three bombs worth, then you've got one to test and two to actually threaten to use.
David, you end the book on a fairly somber note about how complex this situation is. You quote my former boss, Bob Gates, in his Foreign Affairs article from this past winter that talks about the United States now facing the most complex and difficult national security environment we've faced since 1945. You say that that might be an exaggeration, but there's no exaggerating how complex this is. Final question for you as we wrap up today. You know, are we equipped as a nation to do this, given our, you know, our deep political divisions? I mean, this would be a big challenge for a country that was relatively unified. But we are deeply, deeply divided politically now, to the point of, you know, congressional dysfunction. I mean, Politico had a story today about how, you know, we've got all these potential showstoppers lining up, the, you know, debt limit, spending caps, you know, continuing resolutions running out. And they're all going to come, you know, together at the same point in early 2025. Where we'll either have a different, you know, combination of presidents and Congress than we have right now, but not, I don't think there's any reason to believe any of it will be, you know, less inclined to the kind of polarization and dysfunction that we've seen. What do you think the prognosis is for the United States being able to deal with these new Cold Wars?
Well, Mike, you know, central motivating factor in writing this book was to say that just because we don't want to go deal with the world because we're involved in what H.R. McMaster wonderfully calls strategic narcissism, right, along the way here, doesn't mean that the rest of the world is going to stop and say, oh, we'll give you time to go work all of this out. And let us know when you want to go reengage, and we'll be delighted to go do that with you. We're in a competitive world in which Russia is desperately looking for a way to survive and has found its role in the role of disruptor. China is looking for a way to go displace the United States as the central power that attracts other nations around it. Together, they are trying to build an alternative to a Western system. The Iranians call this the axis of resistance, more narrowly talking about their own efforts. But you could apply the phrase as well to this fascinating combination we're seeing come together of Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. And then those nations that China can draw into its area of influence by using Huawei to spread Chinese-made networks around the world, using China Telecom to spread Chinese telecommunications around the world, using, for all of its many flaws, its effort to build basically the new Silk Road initiative to draw in commerce with the rest of the world, very much along the model of what we did in the 1950s after World War II. And we're kind of tuned out to it because we're so wrapped up in our own social divisions, our own political divisions. And what I fear is that by the time we get all of this done, we're going to wake up and look around at a strategic situation that is vastly worse than the one that we inherited at the end of the Cold War, at that moment when we thought everybody was going to just sign on to our system. And we don't even have, not only do we not have a strategy to go deal with this, we don't have a common way to discuss this, thus the Kennedy-Nixon debate issue. At least back in the 60s, rightly or wrongly, we had a common way to discuss it. We made some big mistakes. Vietnam was among them. Okay, but at least we had a common language for this. And that's where we've got to get back. And so, you know, I went into journalism 42 years ago, not because I thought that journalists could decide anything. That's up to policymakers like you and elected leaders. But I do think that journalism still has an enormous capability to put items on the agenda. And I'm hoping that New Cold Wars begins to do exactly that.
Well, David, thank you for joining us today on Shield of the Republic. Our guest has been David Sanger, the chief Washington correspondent of the New York Times and the author of New Cold Wars, China's Rise, Russia's Invasion, and America's Struggle to Defend the West. David, we'll have to have you back when my cohort, Elliot Cohen, is here, so he can, you know, relive the days when you were his tutee at Harvard.
Yeah, well, I think I look forward to that, but I'm not sure I look forward to that. We'll have to see what Elliot says first. Great. Well, thank you, Eric. It's been a great conversation.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.